Hey, I'm Scott. How's things? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly. Today on the show, Peter Oborne from Merry Old England. He'll be talking about Iraq War 2. We don't need to wait for Chilcot. Blair lied us into Iraq. Here's the evidence, he wrote on October the 28th. And, I like evidence. So that should be fun. And then our buddy Rhys Ehrlich is back from a trip to Syria. Been hanging around in Syrian Kurdistan. And has some stories to tell us. Has a brand new piece out in Politico magazine. How Putin is wooing America's closest Syrian allies. And I don't know if he wrote the title or not. The article's not too much about the Russian role, but yeah, there's a point or two to be made there for sure. And here's an interesting new article by Mark Perry I have to read. Looking forward to that. I also have an invite out to Con Hallinan, although I hadn't heard back from him. But I'm hoping that that works out, because he wrote an interesting thing about Turkey. Yeah, I like talking with people about the interesting things they write.
I don't
know. Join the chat room if you want. They hardly say anything, but they're talking more than me. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Hey guys, how's things? Good to see you. scotthorton.org/chat. Fake name and a caption, you're in there. It's an IRC free node chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show if you have a external type application for those kinds of things. All right. I'll start with the domestic police state bad news. And that is that the Ohio medical pot and regular old pot bill failed yesterday by large amounts. And yes, it's true. It was a terribly flawed bill. It was the kind of thing like when they re-legalized alcohol. And still the states just regulate alcohol in the insanest of ways. And mostly to guarantee, you know, fascist-style cartels. That's why everybody drinks Budweiser, man, is because they got the political influence to keep other people's beer off the shelf, you know. It's an ugly way of doing things, and that was what the Ohio law did. But my attitude is, so the goods outweighed the bads there by 1,000,000 to 1. You're talking, first of all, about medicinal use. Never mind people who just like getting high and don't want the law in their way, which is their sacred right of self-ownership. They're human beings that can smoke pot if they want. But we're not even talking about that. We're talking about people who are suffering of illnesses and syndromes and conditions who can be helped and in some cases, you know, saved from terrible pain through the use of medical pot. And now, because of the failure of this, it remains illegal for them to use it. And then same thing for people who are just recreational pot smokers, who it's still, you know, a crime for them to simply possess or trade in pot. And I guess the trading part would have been, you know what, that's the thing is, you legalize the cartel for just these few who are allowed to grow and sell or whatever, still what you're doing is you're, the black market turns gray at that point. It becomes a lot less of a crime and less prosecutable for people to still just sell on the black market in the old way, right? Anyway, and here's also my theory. If the opposition to the corrupt criminal cartel system that was going to grant the right to grow pot to just a few select growers was that bad enough that it helped to defeat the bill, then it seems like they could have passed the whole thing, legalizing the possession and use for medical and other purposes, and then gone back and focused on the cartel part and getting that part repealed and fixed. But now it's suffered a, you know, 2-1 defeat. And so it'll be how many years before Ohio tries again with a less corrupt, you know, form of legalization here that they'll be able to actually get passed. So, I mean, I appreciate the principled stand against the corrupt cronyism and all of that. But you know what? We were talking about innocent people being kidnapped and maybe even killed in police operations to prevent them from using and trading in this stuff. So that ending that immediately has got to be the priority. And look at Colorado and Washington. They have somewhat corrupt, crony, very licensure regulated markets, not free markets. And I don't know all the details of them, but I know that there's a lot of lobbying taking place. And there's a hell of a lot of tax revenue that's flowing straight into the coffers of the states of Colorado and Washington. And that's horrible. You know, every penny they have is a penny that they spend assaulting the minds of helpless young children in their horrible government schools, or locking people up for using cocaine or heroin or some other ridiculous substance, or chasing tax evaders, or whoever they feel like persecuting, who may or may not have actually done anything to anyone other than maybe commit some offense against the state and its edicts. So that's a hell of a double-edged sword, you know? I'm not being sarcastic. The fact that the government is making extra tax money off illegal pot in Colorado is a terrible danger, a terrible side effect of the legalization of pot. But what are you going to do? It's still better than the alternative by a long shot. Now the next focus should be on, let's repeal all those pot taxes. Let's go ahead and repeal as many more laws in Colorado as we can so they have a lot less things to spend that money on persecuting us for. Huh? Yeah. My grammar's not always very good, but I'm always right, so it's okay. Anyway, so that's my thing. I think it's a shame that the Ohio thing lost. And I understand why people opposed it for free market reasons. I'm a free market guy. If it was up to me, I would abolish the state of Ohio. It would just be the land of Ohio, where private property owners owned property. And they could rename it whatever the hell they wanted to, too. It wouldn't even have to be called. It could be the region of Ohio. I don't. But still, and so I'm not completely against participating in democratic processes. I really don't like believing in political heroes, except Ron Paul, who is awesome. But other than that, they're all scum. I wouldn't say, you know, you ought to support this or that guy really under any circumstance, pretty much that I can think of. But I do support causes. And I do support people demanding action on causes, because then, you know, even completely horrible politicians will sometimes vote the right way if they think that's what they better do. So it can be important for people to do that. And especially, you know, when you're talking about issues like referendums and recalls and stuff like this, I'm all for that. Punishing guilty politicians, passing laws over their dead bodies. That's a figure of speech, police state. Figure of speech. Over there, attempted veto or refusal is all I mean. God. Am I paranoid? Or I really do live in a lawless totalitarian police state and better watch what the hell I say. Think a little bit of both, maybe. All right, y'all. See you in a minute. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Tomorrow be a good one. I got Daniel Larrison coming back on the show to talk about some of the wars. I think probably mostly we'll talk about Yemen. And then also this guy, Patrick Eddington. It turns out that he is a Cato guy who used to be a staffer for a congressman whose constituent was kidnapped and renditioned and was threatened with torture back during Bush and Meles Zenawi's invasion of Somalia in 2006 and 2007. And remember that? We covered it at the time. Because we covered it at the time. And, yeah, hadn't heard too much about any accountability, except now they're suing for what the FBI done did to this kid. Acting like the CIA. And here Eddington has written a piece for the New York Times. We're running it on antiwar.com today. And FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk is the name of the title. He's talking about an American citizen there. So very important article, and that'll be an important interview on the show tomorrow. So that should be good. Oh, and then also by special request, but I should have been on top of this anyway. Probably should have done this a long time ago. Somebody asked me to interview Jill Stein of the Green Party. And I thought, yeah, I should do that. So I'm going to. She'll be on the show tomorrow. I guess they're concerned. They're asking, what questions are you going to be asking? Well, let's see. NATO expansion. War against the Islamic State. Special Forces invasion of Africa. China pivot. I don't know, man. You know, her foreign policy. Hey, lady, seriously, if you were the president of history's most powerful empire, what would you do to it? I mean, with it. I mean, what would you do? It ought to be an easy answer. But I don't know. Honestly, I don't know anything about her. She's a Green, so she's got to be an anti-imperialist, right? Maybe I should come up with devil's advocate questions. What if the Chinese start mistreating women really badly more? Should we invade them? What about if the Islamic State regime starts, you know, polluting a lot? Should we invade them then? I don't know, man. All right. I guess I'll talk about Gene Healy's thing. He couldn't do the show. But it's worth bringing up. More mission creep in an illegal war. And this is about how there's no congressional authorization for this war. They are ridiculously falling back on the authorization to use military force from September 2001, which was against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Nice loose language, didn't quite say that. And now they're just pretending and have added the term associated forces, which isn't even in there. It's not even in there. And they just say, oh, come on, the AOMF says we can kill whoever we want. And then they also, I think, almost just to draw attention to how completely full of it they are, invoked the Iraq War Authorization of 2002, which was specifically referring to the government of Iraq in Baghdad, which right now, of course, is a joint project, has been since 2002 and 3, a joint project of America and Iran working together. The fight in Iraq is to help them against the Islamic State. So how in the hell, after America changed that regime, does the authorization against the last regime count? You've got to be kidding. They must be kidding. And of course, the Islamic State has, you know, avowedly said that Ayman al-Zawahiri can go and screw himself. He's not the boss of them, which means they're not associated forces with al-Qaeda. They're the enemies of al-Qaeda. They suicide bomb al-Qaeda guys in Syria to death all the time. The guys that are still the guys that are still loyal to Zawahiri right now. So, anyway, there's no authority to do this. And, you know, I don't know, I get it. The Constitution is a dead letter. It is just a damned piece of paper. Although, by the way, there's no reason to believe that George W. Bush ever said that. That came from Capitol Hill Blue paper. Is that even still around? Capitol Hill Blue website? Something like that. And they were always making up a bunch of crap. There was no real source for that. But anyway, he might as well have said it because it's true. And unless the Congress is going to impeach and remove the president for violating the Constitution and violating the law, he's going to go ahead and get away with it, same as he did in Libya. They had a vote on an authorization for the Libya war. It failed. They tried to bring a resolution forward, Kucinich did, that would specifically denounce the war and unauthorize it, demand Obama halt it, and John Boehner, the coward war criminal, refused to allow it to come to the floor to be voted on. And Obama said, well, it's not a war, it's just a kinetic action. So it doesn't count. All we're doing is backing al-Qaeda guys on the ground with air power, and so that doesn't count as a war. After all, we're on the side of our enemies against our ally. Okay, that wasn't really their legal reasoning, but I'm just trying to rationalize, you know. And same thing here. President Obama has no authority to put troops on the ground in Syria. Now, in Iraq, the government there also denies that they've asked us. They want trainers only, no combat troops. Obama says, I'm sending in combat troops anyway. In both cases, especially in Syria, I guess, you don't even have the pretense that we're invited. In Iraq, they claim they're invited by the Iraqi government, even while they deny it. In Syria, everybody knows that Assad has not invited the United States to put soldiers on the ground there. They're recognizing the sovereignty of the Syrian Kurds just long enough to stab them in the back, I guess. And it's all illegal. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, and God dang it, Bobby, I can't get a hold of my guest. Well, you know, his Skype symbol, it just ain't green. No green, no call. So here I am without a guest. God dang it, Bobby. But that's all right, because I'll just talk about other stuff. As I get tons of stuff to talk about. And here in a little while, maybe I'll get a hold of him. But if not, doesn't matter, because here in a little while, I'll still get a hold of Reese Ehrlich, and that'll be good. He's good on all kinds of stuff. You know, I had an invite out to Ramsey, too, man. See if I could get Ramsey Brew back on. All right. This is from the Jewish Daily Forward by J.J. Goldberg, who I believe is their editor, or their senior editor, or their editor emeritus, or their, you know, something like that. Israel's top generals split with Benjamin Netanyahu on the roots of the terror wave. And, fast forward here, jeez. So he goes back over the whole blaming the Palestinians for the Holocaust crap. But here we go. Coincidentally or not, however, voices have been raised in a most unlikely corner to insist that Palestinian hostility to Israel, including Palestinian terrorist violence, is at least partly a response to Israeli actions and policies, and not simply a deep-seated hatred of Jews. That corner is the Israel Defense Forces. In the days after, well, they are a notorious group of anti-Semites. Especially their leaders, you know? In the days after Netanyahu's speech, two active-duty IDF generals, who are among the army's top experts on Palestinian affairs, spoke out publicly to state that Palestinian violence is driven to a considerable degree by anger at Israeli actions. One of the two went a step further, warning that only a serious Israeli diplomatic re-engagement with the Palestinians will help to quell such violence over the long term. There you go. Well, I'll continue here. J.J. Goldberg in the Ford. This might seem like more of the same old that we've been hearing for several years now, questioning of Netanyahu's policies by senior figures in the Israeli defense establishment. But it's not. This is something new. Up to now, almost all public pushback from the security community has come from retired ex-service chiefs who are now private citizens and free to speak their minds. Their unanimity may well tell us something important about Israeli defense doctrine, as I've argued before. Indeed, many of them remain in close touch and da-da-da. But there's a difference when active-duty generals speak out. IDF generals, unlike, say, Israeli cabinet ministers, are not free to spout off publicly with opinions that contradict their immediate bosses. When they do speak out, therefore, their views can be assumed to reflect those of the IDF command. Accordingly, for a high-ranking active-duty general to voice a view that's at odds with strongly held views of the Prime Minister is nothing less than shocking, because it's the voice of the IDF. And that's what has started happening now. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe Americans can learn a lesson here about the whole they hate us because how good and innocent we are thing when the example is somebody else. Can you believe that anybody in Israel believes that? I mean, what are they going to do? Blame Islamic fundamentalism? For people in the West Bank? Yeah, I don't know, man. Nah, that's not a very credible thing there. So they just blame. Well, they have a socialist state over there. The whole hate them because they're free thing is, war little thin. So, oh yeah, they hate them just because they're Jewish. That's what every Israeli is supposed to believe. That's what every American is supposed to believe. Why would a Palestinian take out a knife and attack a soldier? You know, where are these terrorists coming from anyway, etc. But you know, the answer's right there. Just look at the picture. The answer's right there. Wait a minute. How come these people only have knives and not rifles? It's because gun control works. That's why the Israelis have disarmed them. They've been conquered for 48 years. They lost the war back in 1967. They're under permanent martial law from a foreign power. That's why all they have is knives. They're not invading from somewhere else. They're the invaded, the occupied. And imagine when the frame of mind of a society and a government, when, you know, virtually their chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff basically has to come out and say, whoa, 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 hold on. Let's not get too caught up in our narrative here, okay? We are taking East Jerusalem from them. You know, let's not pretend that, oh, they just have this religion that makes them hate the innocent. There's something more going on. Well, you can relate. You live in a society where we have to insist on the side of all reason against pure fantasy and ignorance and stupidity. Of course, as I was explaining on the show yesterday, a big part of the reason that America has a terrorist problem is because of Israel. I mean, a lot of it is because of direct actions by the U.S. government, no doubt, but a lot of those direct actions include bankrolling and arming the Israelis in their permanent wars against the Palestinians and the Lebanese. And that's been true since long before September 11th. Not just, oh, well, our policies have been counterproductive since then. It was the last decades of the 20th century what led up to the first decades of this one. Anyway, so, and by the way, that's not Jeffrey Goldberg, and that's not Jonah Goldberg. That's J.J. Goldberg in the foreword. He's an interesting writer. I don't know all about his whole history and whatever, but he writes some interesting stuff. And here he is just explaining, just quoting these generals in simple terms, explaining. The first to speak out was Major General Nitzan Olan, currently chief of the General Staff Operations Directorate. He moved up last May after nearly a decade as commander of Israel's military presence in the West Bank, first as commander of the Judea-Samaria Division, that's what they call the West Bank, then as chief of Central Command. Alon testified on October 22nd in a trial involving two settlers accused of incitement for publishing the Kahanist-leaning Jewish Voice website. Some of the motivations of the, well, for free speech, but anyway, that was their trial. Some of the motivation of the Palestinians to carry out, quote, some of the motivation of the Palestinians to carry out terror attacks is due to the violence of right-wing elements in the West Bank, Alon told the court, according to Haaretz and numerous other news sources. Quote, in my understanding, there are many reasons for Palestinian violence, some of them related to the murderous behavior of the terrorists, some related to religious and nationalistic motives, and a certain part, not the main part, that is related to revenge activity due to the activity of, Sorry, my bad emphasis there on the pronunciation of the thing. That is related to revenge activity due to the activity of Israelis against Palestinians. He also said a significant part of Israeli violence against Palestinians stems from Palestinian violence against Israelis. Yeah, well, who's occupying who? That's the relevant question. All right, hang on a minute. Looks like we're going to have our guest, Peter Oborn, here in just a minute, guys.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right. Well, his jammer's green, but now he's not answering. So, whatever, dude. All right. Good, I was in the middle of talking about Israel anyway. So check this out. This is from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. Extremism and incitement to racial hatred. Senior Israeli officials in their own words. Palestinians are beasts. They are not human. Then Deputy Minister of Religious Services and current Deputy Minister of Defense. Deputy Minister of Defense, Rabbi Eli Ben Dahan. What's so horrifying about understanding that the entire Palestinian people is the enemy? Love that when people singularize plurals that way. The entire Palestinian people is the enemy. Not even are. They are all enemy combatants, and their blood shall be on all their heads. Now this also includes the mothers of the martyrs who send them to hell with flowers and kisses. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical homes in which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there. That is a quote from the current Minister of Justice, Ilet Shaked, quoting a former settler activist and speechwriter and advisor for Netanyahu. Very happily. Yes, their children, they're all terrorists. They're snakes, in fact, inhuman. And their mother's just snake factories. Who else should be exterminated and their land bulldozed? Everybody knows that. Come on. Hey, come on, Scott. The Attorney General of every state in the land talks that way. Right? That's how we do business in the American Empire. The Sudanese are a cancer in our body. We will do everything to send them back where they came from. I don't know. That doesn't sound too far outside of Republican Party politics there. Referring to immigrants. I'm just a little facetious. Those who are with us deserve everything. But those who are against us deserve to have their heads chopped off with an axe. Then Foreign Minister and leader of the Yisrael Beitenu party, Avigdor Lieberman. And I've seen the footage of that. He's not joking around. He's not making some, like, inside joke allusion to the Islamic State or something like that. He's just saying they should have their heads chopped off with an axe. Our soldiers are the only innocents in Gaza. Boy, you know where this is going. Jeez. Let's see. A population that's mostly under the age of 18. Anyway, among them, quote, our soldiers are the only innocents in Gaza. Under no circumstances should they be killed because of false morality that prefers to protect enemy civilians. One hair on the head of an Israeli soldier is more precious than the entire Gazan populace, which elected Hamas and supports and encourages anyone who murders Israelis. That is then Deputy Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, the Knesset, from Netanyahu's Likud party, Moshe Feiglin.
A Jew always has a much higher soul than a Gentile, even if he is a homosexual. That is a quote of then Deputy Minister of Religious Services and current Deputy Minister of Defense. Current Deputy Minister of Defense. Rabbi Eli Ben Dahan. Oh, that's the same asshole again from earlier. I am happy to be a fascist. That is a quote from Miri Regev, current Minister of Culture and Sport. 2012. There are 92,000 families in Israel in which one of the partners is not Jewish. We have a real problem that we have to deal with. That's Zippy Hodelevi. Current Deputy Foreign Minister. The Palestinian threat harbors cancer-like attributes that have to be severed. There are all kinds of solutions to cancer. Some say it's necessary to amputate organs. But at the moment, I am applying chemotherapy. Then General and current Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon. Now that one is more just, oh, boo-hoo, offensive. I mean, yeah, it's dehumanizing. I'd like to know more of the context. Is he talking about an actual policy of stealing people's land? Or just mass arrests of people's children, or, you know, whatever. I'd like to know more of the circumstance we meant there, but. The cancer one. That one is, nah, not as bad to me, but whatever. Only on a list of, you know, quotes that could have come from Goebbels. The way to deal with Palestinians is to beat them up. Not once, but repeatedly. Beat them up so it hurts so badly until it's unbearable. Benjamin Netanyahu, current prime minister, while in the opposition following his first term as prime minister, caught on video speaking to Israeli settlers, 2001. And, of course, that's the same video where he talks about screwing Bill Clinton right in the face. Oh, yeah, don't worry about the Americans. America's a thing that is easily moved. It's absurd how easy Americans are to manipulate. Gloated the current prime minister of Israel. And anyway, so just imagine right now any American politician talking about American blacks or Hispanics like this. And I know a couple of these come pretty close to Donald Trump. Like the cancer thing, I could see Trump maybe getting away with that. But this whole thing, imagine an American politician saying about blacks that they're beasts, not human. That their children are little snakes and their mothers should be exterminated. Can you imagine that? What would happen? I know, you're thinking, well, they'd get promoted for a little while, but then at some point that would become a scandal, right? Right? That's from America's horrible past when American government officials openly spoke that way about those they oppress, right? Right? I don't know. That's the thing, man. You get this double standard, and then, so which one becomes the single standard at the end of the day? Is it ours or theirs? You know, I don't know. Maybe racial nationalism isn't that bad. The Israelis seem to think it's pretty good. Don't! God dang it! But the thing is that, no, it's not, and they shouldn't behave that way. But, you know, if you look at the white supremacists, they cite the Israelis and then they make fun of other conservatives and say, you know, look at what a hypocrite you are. You're all for ethnic supremacy in Israel, but not for America. How ugly. But yeah, so anyway, there you go. You can find all those quotes at extremism and incitement to racial hatred, senior Israeli officials in their own words. And you know, the one guy, one of these guys who was talking about how inhuman they all are was the same guy who was saying, it's this guy, Moshe Feiglin, the guy who was saying one hair
on an Israeli soldier's head is worth more than the entire human population of the Gaza Strip. Is the same guy who was saying that they all ought to just be forced marched out of Gaza into the Sinai Peninsula, into the desert to die, basically. And all of Gaza should be taken by the Israelis. So that's just a preview for the not-too-distant future, probably, for you right there. It's the only democracy in the Middle East, except that fully half of the people there have no rights at all. No rights. At all. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show. The Scott Horton Show. Hey, man, so yeah, that interview didn't work out because, geez, some people can't count to five. And so getting somebody on the line in England can, you know, be difficult. But, it doesn't matter because now it's time for Reese Ehrlich. And I thought that was cool that when I saw that he wrote a thing brand new out, in Politico magazine, how Putin is wooing America's closest Syrian allies. Welcome back to the show, Reese. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Can you hear me okay?
Actually, sound pretty bad. Is there a reason you're...
Yeah, let me make an adjustment here.
Yeah.
All right. Any better now?
Yeah.
Any better now?
Yeah, sure. Hang on
all
one
right.
second.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no problem. So the thing is that, you guys should know that Reese has written about 10 million books on the Middle East and the American Empire. He's got a real understanding of all this stuff. And if I read this thing right, you just got back from, Iraqi Kurdistan and or Syrian Kurdistan, both?
No, just Iraqi Kurdistan and Jordan.
Okay. And, all right, well, so it's a gigantic, complicated mess. I guess I'll start us off here with, Obama's announcement. He's putting troops, special forces embedded with the Kurds. But I got to tell you, Reese, I don't know if you saw the same things I saw. I don't know if I did. But I think I saw possible reference to plans to embed these special forces with the so-called mythical moderates, meaning, you know, more or less Ahrar al-Sham and very possibly in alliance on the ground with al-Nusra. And it seems like, as you say here, the Russians get along with the Kurds, so there's no problem there, but we could get our guys bombed by the Turks if Erdogan follows through on his promises to attack the Kurds in Syria. And then if they embed the special forces with the mythical moderates and they're even worse jihadist buddies, then they could get them bombed by the Russians and get us into a real war. If you want to talk about real wars, so tell me that I'm crazy and I shouldn't worry about getting into a war with our best ally, the Turks, or our supposed worst enemy, the Russians here.
You're crazy and paranoid and a conspiracy theorist. How's
Thank
that?
You, God.
as usual, you have some insights. Huge mistake what Obama is doing. I was there a year ago. I predicted that when the bombing didn't work, they'd have to send in ground troops or find some ground troops to send in. And sure enough, that's what they're doing. It's a sign of weakness, not of strength or determination. The fact that we're losing the war, you can't win a ground war without somebody on the ground. And now they're putting U.S. troops on the ground. As for who the U.S. is going to be aligned with, it's you were close, but not quite. They're going to fight with the Syrian Kurds, who are led by the Democratic Union Party, or PYD, and The PYD has just in the last couple of weeks set up a new coalition that they claim includes Syrian Arab fighters who are not extremists. However, these are the mythical moderates that you're referring to. Nobody actually knows how many or how strong and these groups are. And in fact, there's indications that they're quite weak. Yesterday's New York Times had a front page lead story on exactly this topic that I've been covering for a while. And so the situation is the U.S. is going to be indeed putting its own soldiers in danger, not only fighting Islamic State, but as you mentioned, the Turks, who hate the Syrian Kurds as they hate the Turkish Kurds.
Right. And so, now Erdogan has promised that he would attack the Kurds if they move west of the Euphrates River, but and there's got to be some kind of agreement with the Americans that you're at least going to wait until we're done using them against the Islamic State for a little while, and then after we stab them in the back, then you can bomb them, but not while our guys are there, right?
Yeah, well, everybody's got their knives out, and you better watch your back. You're absolutely right about that. Well, the problem is the Turks don't play by the same rules that the United States does, which doesn't, of course, play by the rules that anybody else does. So even recently, in the last few months, the Turks have been bombing the Syrian Kurds, even while the U.S. has been dropping 50 tons of ammunition and arms to those very same Kurds. So the U.S. has not been able to stop them from bombing the Syrian Kurds, because the Erdogan, as you mentioned, sees the Kurds as big an enemy, as if not bigger enemy, than the Islamic State. So it's a very dangerous situation, very dangerous for U.S. troops, and absolutely guaranteed to fail politically and militarily.
All right, and so now tell me more about these mythical moderates and their proportions. And this just means anybody backed by the CIA, and does this include Ahrar al-Sham, or how do you break that down?
Well, it doesn't formally include those folks. Again, for your listeners who may have already fallen asleep during this conversation with all these different names and acronyms and so on, there's the three strongest rebel groups in Syria now are the Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the affiliate of al-Qaeda, and Ahrar al-Sham, the group you just mentioned. They are all right-wing extremists who use Islam as the excuse to basically put themselves in dictatorial power. And they all hate each other, or at least everyone hates the Islamic State. Now, in addition to those three major groups, there are some smaller militias. There's kind of remnants of the Free Syrian Army. There's these groups fighting in northern Syria. What the PYD has said, that is the Syrian Kurds, say that they have helped local Christians, Yazidis, and others to form militias, or they've worked with tribal chiefs to form militias who will fight the Islamic State in alliance with them. That's who the U.S. is betting on as the so-called moderate forces, not the extremist groups. The problem is those folks don't actually represent much. They don't have much in the way of discipline or armed presence. They certainly are not armed. And to bet the farm on such an untried, untested group and declare them as the new saviors of the moderate elements is a serious mistake.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, so there have been contradictory statements, of course, all along about this. But it sounds like they've decided that they want to keep the state but still get rid of Assad. And it even sounds like maybe they've convinced the Russians that they can do that, too. Forget de-Ba'athification and abolition of the army. They learned that lesson, at least. But it seems like they still are intent on getting rid of Assad. But I wonder whether you think that they can do one and not the other.
You're talking about they being the U.S.?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I guess it sounds like they've almost convinced Putin that it's possible to do, no?
Well, Putin ain't that stupid. here's what I think is happening. 1 year ago, the U.S. made a massive shift in strategy. Instead of calling for and arming groups to overthrow Assad, they said the Islamic State is the main enemy, and to some extent, al-Nusra. And for the last year, the U.S. has tried to build up forces and ally with people who want to fight the Islamic State, putting off the overthrow of Assad till somewhere down the line. Now, that could coincide with what Putin wants, but probably not, because Putin can see through that and says, yeah, well, today you're fighting the Islamic State, but tomorrow you're going to come after our guy, Assad. And when Putin started bombing at the end of September, what he was doing, that was a massive admission of failure. You know, you don't introduce new arms and troops and bombing raids when you're winning. You actually decrease that. You only do that when you're losing. And Assad is down to controlling roughly one third of the country. And Assad is basically stepping in to save his bacon. So the problem, of course, is the U.S. doesn't want Russia to have any more influence in Syria than they want Iran or Assad or anyone else. So the U.S. is stepping up its military game. And there's the real danger, which is that there's so many folks bombing in Syria and so many fighting that the chances of running into each other and killing each other, even by accident, has increased.
Yeah. Well, apparently they even did a little drill with American and Russian planes practicing what happens if they get too close to each other. There's a story about that on antiwar.com today. That's kind of good news, I guess.
That makes life encouraging, doesn't it?
Yeah, a lot. All right, hang tight. We'll be right back, y'all, with Reese Ehrlich in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, we're talking about the tangled mess in the Syria war there with Reese Ehrlich. And so now the Russians obviously have called America and its allies bluff on invading there. But, you know, as soon as they did, and I should have thought of this before, but I just didn't think the Russians were going to go that far. But once the Russians went that far, it occurred to me that, hey, man, is it possible that my government is run by people who are slightly more evil than stupid, and that maybe they actually had a deliberate plan, as Zbigniew Brzezinski at least claims he had before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, to back the Mujahideen, to make them a bigger nuisance in order to provoke the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And maybe that's what they're doing here, backing the Mujahideen to make them more of a problem. They threatened the Najibullah slash Assad regime there in Damascus. And then, it wasn't Najibullah then, but you know what I mean, the commie regime. And then provoke the Russians into invading, and then, haha, good luck fighting a bunch of Mujahideen backed by American and Saudi money, just like the old days. And who cares about September 11th? That was mostly just a bunch of non-government employees who died, so they don't really matter in our government's policy. And I went off track. But the point is, I thought, nah, you know, that's a little too fanciful that they would have done this on purpose to lure the Russians into this trap. But then I saw a story in Defense News about how Robert Gates said to the Senate that he thinks, I guess his language was from the outside, it looks to him like, apparently, that was his word, apparently this is Obama's policy, is to draw the Russians in and bog them down. He didn't think it was a very good one. He thought we should flex our muscles and force them out. But that was what he characterized Obama's policy, Obama's former Secretary of Defense Gates. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's giving the U.S. and Washington in general too much credit. It's pretty Machiavellian to have intended to lose the war to increase groups that are murdering not only Syrians, but Westerners and Americans when they get a chance, and as a way to encourage a Russian invasion. I think there's a much more straightforward way to look at it. The U.S. operates Plan A, Plan B, Plan C. Plan A was to provide arms and training to pro-U.S. rebels who would overthrow Assad and install a pro-U.S. regime in Damascus. That didn't work. That almost fell apart almost immediately. Plan B, try to weaken the Assad government, allow the Saudis and the Turks to take the lead in promoting extremist groups and not doing anything to stop that, and that way overthrow Assad and have a pro-Western government. That plan B didn't work either. So now we're down, you know, C, D, E, and we're down to about plan W, and that consists of trying to prevent the country from fragmenting entirely. I think the U.S. wasn't intentionally trying to provoke the Russians. I'm sure they had some scenarios in which that would happen, but it's not a good thing for the U.S. that the Russians are sending in troops and Iran is sending in troops. It makes the imposition of a pro-U.S. regime all the more difficult.
Mm. Although, I mean, they're... Oh, I'm sorry. Could you do me a favor? Maybe turn your speakers down just a little bit.
Yeah,
getting a little echo there.
Getting feedback. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, part of the problem here is this entire policy has been completely insane. In the first place, you would think from the point of view of the government, not from the point of view of a non-interventionist, but from the point of view of the government, that hey, the enemy here are the Sunni jihadists, Bin Ladenites. And so whoever's fighting them, at least we're going to stand out of the way. And, of course, I don't know what you think about this. It seems to me like if America had told Turkey and Saudi and Qatar and the rest of our and Israel to not back the jihadists all this time, that Assad would have won this war about 200,000 lives ago. And, you know, it would have been a pretty rough peace. But they've really just sustained this slaughter and basically for nothing. Now you're telling me their policy is to prevent the breakup of Syria that they just cut in thirds, you know?
I mean, well, that's plan Y. That is to split up Syria and take whatever portion of it that they can to be a pro-U.S. enclave. That's essentially what they've done in Iraq with the Kurdish region of Iraq. But back on your main point, you know, from the very beginning, Assad got military and political support from Russia and from Iran. The rebels got their support from the U.S., Israel, Qatar, Turkey, and the other countries you mentioned. So it's very hard to parse out if no foreign powers had been involved. I think it's quite possible that the civil society activists and the conservative Muslim parties such as the Muslim Brotherhood, but not the extremists like the Islamic State, could have come to power. I think in the first year of the uprising, that was still a distinct possibility. But Assad and his allies did everything possible to block that. So, you know, I don't think it's, given the history of it, I don't think it's possible to predict what that Assad would have won or the rebels would have won. Everybody got their international backing, and that's just increased over the years. And Assad is a brutal dictator. He's secular, or he certainly was, but he now relies on appeals to religious prejudice to keep himself in power. And the Sunnis who do live in areas that are controlled by the government are subject to massive discrimination and security checks. It looks like what Israel does to the Palestinians. I've interviewed people directly for that because all Sunnis living in the government-controlled areas are suspect of being supporters of the rebels. So let's be careful. You know, the Assad is certainly no great hero.
Well, I never said that. I just said he would have won the war if America and its allies hadn't dumped $10 zillion and 10 zillion bullets into the damn argument. That's all.
Well, maybe. But maybe if Iran and Russia hadn't backed him, he would have fallen very quickly. Hard to say.
Although if Iran and Russia had backed them, then we still wouldn't be talking about the guys that did the 9/11 attacks and, you know, five before that and 1,000 since then and fought against our guys for 8 years in Iraq War II. We'd be talking about, oh, boo-hoo Hezbollah that hadn't attacked America since 1983 when America was in Beirut. Right?
You lost me on that one, Scott.
I'm saying... you're saying, well, all could have been foreign intervention this way or that. I'm saying America and its allies' intervention has been on behalf of the 9/11 attackers, on behalf of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria.
The point you made earlier was valid, which is that when Turkey and Saudi Arabia in particular began backing the al-Nusra Front, which is allied with Al-Qaeda, and at that time was all included the Islamic State people, The U.S. could have stopped that by laying down the laws, threatening to cut military spending and put other pressure on Saudi Arabia. They could have stopped it. They didn't. They were willing to work with those folks against Assad in hopes that it would overthrow Assad and somehow they could change things later. Same thing's going on in Yemen. Today, the Saudis and the Emiratis have invaded and bombed Yemen. And who's flourished as a result? Al-Qaeda, the most dangerous Al-Qaeda franchise in the world, the one that was responsible for the shoe bomber and the other direct airplane attempts at terrorist attacks on the United States. Mm-hmm. They now control several cities and an area that they didn't control before because the Saudis are perfectly willing to work with them against what they see as a bigger danger, the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the one where it's the most ironic. If America's on split sides of the war against the Islamic State, in a way, you know, sort of kind of supporting their side in a way, at least in against the Shia and the Baathists in Syria, while helping the Iranian Shia side fight them in Iraq. In Yemen, America's fighting on both sides of the war with Al-Qaeda at the same time, helping the Saudis fly as their air force while still doing drone strikes on them, at least occasionally. At least they're claiming. So that's one where you can't get more ironic than that one.
Well, it shows you how confused U.S. policy is. They really don't, like I said, they've gone through their plans A, B, C, D, and are pretty low into the alphabet by now.
Yeah. Hey, I got a plan. Just quit and see what happens, you know.
Not a bad idea. Stop the bombing. Pull the troops out. Let the people try to resolve it themselves. You know, we won't be, in a year from now, we're going to be talking about why the U.S. escalated its troop commitments to save our boys. You know, the minute you put combat troops on the ground in Syria, what if some of them are wounded or killed? Well, right. We've got to send in more to protect them. We can't leave our boys isolated. And pretty soon you've got a much bigger troop commitment. And what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Well, stop it at the beginning.
Yeah, it's like that movie V for Vendetta, where it's the near distant future and on the TV news in the background, the American war in Kurdistan continues to rage today. You know, just
I saw that movie again recently. You're right. It's not bad. It's not a bad movie.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good, man. All right. Hey, listen, man, I really appreciate what you do, Reese, and great article here and great interview.
All right. People can check out ReeseErlich.com is my webpage.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Check out my articles and books. Inside Syria is my latest book. Available on Amazon and bookstores around the country.
Yeah, there you go. And check out that page on Amazon.com, y'all. You'll be impressed for real. Inside Syria and ReeseErlich.com. Thanks again, Reese. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm sorry if I was screwing that great interview up, man. Reese Ehrlich is great. I'm sitting here in a Twitter war. Not even a war, just a damn doing too many things at once while I should be paying attention to my stupid radio show. Hey, guys, thanks for listening. Good chat room today. Join up. Talk with the guys about, you know, El Caminos, whatever. Things going on, politics. The totalitarian police state. All right. That's got to go. That's, I don't know, maybe tomorrow, I hope. That's tomorrow. That I hadn't read yet. Netanyahu seeks $4.5 billion a year. Boy, What'd it take for America to ever get sick of this guy, huh? Last night I did an episode of Eye on the Empire, an episode of Eye on the Empire with me and Jeff Tucker at liberty.me. You can watch it if you want to. And we talked about the TPP. And that's the big new trade agreement patent thing. Horrible patent thing. And let's see. And we talked about the wars. We talked about Yemen. Now, this article is by Jeffrey Gettleman, which is problematic. And I haven't even read it yet, which is even more problematic. But I'm very interested in what it says, and I think you might also be. It's at the New York Times. Popular hotel in Somalia is bombed by militants. Mogadishu, November 1st. Islamist militants stormed a popular hotel. Maybe that's how Jeffrey Gettleman knows about it, huh? Never leaves his hotel. Get it? Islamist militants stormed a popular hotel in the heart of Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, on Sunday, blowing up the front gate with a car bomb, shooting guests and hotel workers, and then battling with security forces from the hotel's rooftop for several hours. Somali government officials said at least 14 people at the Sahafi Hotel were killed in the attack, which was immediately and gleefully claimed by the Shabab militant group. If there's one hotel everyone knows in Mogadishu, it's the Sahafi. Warlords and militants alike used it to hang out and plot schemes in the lounge and courtyard while sipping great... Shut up. Sahafi means journalist in Arabic. And for years, the hotel has served as the gateway to one of the world's... See, I told you. Gettleman, he hangs around the hotel all day. Gotta go on about that. So now this is the part of the show where I tell you about the background to this thing. Al-Shabaab used to be nothing to nobody. Al-Shabaab means the youth, the guys that did this thing. Oh, way back in history, turn of the century. What happened was after September 11th, you might remember, I have the clip, don't I? I have it right here.
A memo that describes how we're going to take out... This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Okay, so that's General Wesley Clark, the Butcher of Waco. General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO that almost got us into World War III with the Russians over the Pristina Airport back in 1999. The sickening madman who ran for president in 2004. Anyway, what he's talking about there is the neoconservative agenda. 9/11 has happened. Here's every enemy of Israel on the list. Every country we want to attack, destabilize, install a puppet, whatever it is.
This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
And, of course, by Lebanon, he means Hezbollah. And anyway, yes, in southern Lebanon. Anyway, so the Americans, man, they immediately stepped up. The CIA stepped up covert operations in Syria, supporting the warlords, the bad guys from Black Hawk Down. Adid was the warlord that they were after that day. The CIA started supporting his son. And associated other butchers and monsters and criminals. And what they said was, hunt down and kill Islamists for us. And they said, sure, give us money and guns. And then they killed whoever they wanted. They killed their enemies. And they became a, major nuisance to the people of Somalia. Who, it should be noted at the time, had basically, because the warlords had fought them, each other to exhaustion, had a basically free society and had the most prosperous society that they had had since the days of colonialism. And they'd been stuck under communism and then civil war for decades and decades. And finally, they had a little bit of freedom. And if you look at my article, U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery in the Future Freedom, I cite my sources there where they really showed how it was the best the Somali economy had ever been, had ever done. And there are basically no taxes or warlords or controls at the port. Business was booming, massive new cell phone industry, and the quality of life, the food distribution and all that was, and healthcare and everything better than ever before, with no government at all. It wasn't paradise. It was paradise compared to usual Somalia. That's what it was. It was Somalia doing better than you could have imagined, is what it was. But then the people formed a government to protect themselves from the CIA-backed warlords, and they called it, well, in fact, now I'm skipping a couple of steps. The people came together to fight the warlords and beat them back across the border into Ethiopia. Then the CIA backed them even more. And they came back into the country and started attacking again. And only at that point, in 2005, did they really coalesce, or late 2004, early 2005. These disparate groups, 13 disparate groups, came together to create what was called the Islamic Courts Union, which was ruled by the grandfathers and the uncles and the imams and the old men, and at the exclusion of the warlords. And Al-Shabaab was the smallest and the least influential group among the 13. They were the youth. You guys are allowed to come to the meeting, but you'll sit there and be quiet while the old men decide what to do. So they were portrayed as, you know, Al-Qaeda on Earth, but they weren't even, you know, reincarnate at the time. Al-Qaeda hardly existed anymore except a couple of dozen guys, right? But they were portrayed as basically a bunch of bin Ladenite terrorists, even though they really didn't have the motivation. They closed movie theaters and a couple of Taliban sounding things, but they certainly didn't have the authority to clamp down in any totalitarian measure whatsoever. And they're not a bunch of radical international terrorists or friends with any either. But no matter, come Christmas 2006, Bush and his government basically forced, and you can read Rob Prince at Foreign Policy and Focus all about this, and I interviewed him about it. According to the WikiLeaks, thank you Chelsea Manning, doing 35 years in the brig for our government's sins. According to the WikiLeaks, the Bush administration basically forced Meles Zenawi, the dictator of Ethiopia, to invade, which his army was sure happy to do, as they raped and murdered and pillaged their way across Somalia and turned the place completely upside down. And Al-Shabaab, at that point, guess what became all that was left of the Islamic Courts Union? The young men with the rifles who were willing to fight. And they grew into this terrible terrorist group, as almost as bad as the Ethiopian occupation itself. And they ended up allying themselves with Al-Qaeda. And none of this had to happen at all. Oh, and it ended up starving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people to death when the famine came during the war. When the drought came during the war, I meant. You know what I mean. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Man, why the hell do I gotta tweet things, man? I can just say them on the radio. Isn't it okay to blame Chalabi? and the neocons and Bush and the Ayatollah and Ariel Sharon and everybody who was responsible for conspiring to lie us into war with Iraq in 2003. Now, people are saying, oh, Jalabi fooled us into doing it. We didn't even want to do it, except that that guy, Jalabi, why, he tricked us into doing it. Well, that's not true. That's really just a reference to all his lies about the weapons of mass destruction. But that's not what convinced Bush to do the war. But it is true that Jalabi convinced Richard Perle and David Wurmser and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, this is what's going to happen. If you invade Iraq, the Shia will bow down, will bend over and take it. They'll be the supermajority, but they love being told what to do. And either we'll give them a Hashemite king, we'll give them a cousin of the King of Jordan somehow, or, you know, maybe me, to be the new leader. And then we'll screw the Iranians. They won't win any influence in southern Iraq. Why did Saddam invade Iran in 1980? No one knows. Certainly wasn't worried about Iranian influence in southern Iraq or anything like that. Right? Yeah, no, we'll limit the influence of the Iranians. We'll be allies with the Israelis and we'll build an oil and water pipeline to Haifa and we'll put all this pressure on Bashar al-Assad in Syria and pull the rug out from under his support for Hezbollah in Lebanon. That is all the stupid wrong crap that Richard Perle and David Wurmser and Paul Wolfowitz and the ringleaders of the neocons believed. And these are the guys who lied us into war. These are the guys who lied Bush into war. And yes, they were stupid and evil and premeditated, and their entire 90% of their motivation was a Ariel Sharon Likud party motivation, not even an American interest-based one at all. But that doesn't mean that they weren't stupid idiots. And that doesn't mean that they didn't let their buddy, Ahmed Jalabi, lie to them about what was going to be the likely result. So, I don't know. I don't see why it's exculpatory to say that, you know, Wolfowitz and them are stupid idiots as much as they're premeditated mass murderers. They are damned fools. And I don't think that just because I do believe that if Bush did not have Wolfowitz in them to turn to say, oh, yes, sir, believe us, we've studied it and it's going to be great when we do this, then it would have been a lot harder to do. I mean, maybe they would have done it anyway, but the fact that they believed all these great results were going to occur was a big part of why they did it. And Ahmed Jalabi and his CIA and Iranian-funded lies were a big part of that. So, certainly, if a headline is saying, oh, because Jalabi frightened Bush with all his ghost stories of weapons of mass destruction, whatever, well, that's stupid crap. But if you read how Ahmed Jalabi conned the neocons, I think that you will agree that, yeah, he sold them a load of crap. And any idiot should have known better. You know, there was a Tom Clancy book that came out before the war, like a year or two before the war, where the plot was an Iranian sleeper agent gets on Saddam Hussein's security detail and shoots him in the back of the head. Dictator falls down dead, blam, immediately the supermajority Shiite population of the country inherits the power. And the Iranians send in all their agents to basically rule it. Southern Iraq becomes a province of Iran overnight. Because that's what would happen if there was a decapitation against the ruler of the Ba'ath Party in Baghdad. Any idiot knows that, unless they're Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and David Wurmser. And I'll highly recommend these two great articles by Dan Sanchez. Again, if you want to do the work, go and read A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm and Coping with Crumbling States, both by David Wurmser and signed off, at least the first one was signed off by Pearl and Fife and them. But you could just read, you know, the antiwar.com summary. Dan Sanchez has a great one for you there, a great two of them. It's From Clean Break to Dirty Wars. From Clean Break to Dirty Wars. And the other one is called Seizing the Chaos, or just Seize the Chaos. I always get it wrong. Seize the Chaos. And that's a quote out of Coping with Crumbling States. What we want to do is expedite the chaotic collapse of Syria so that then we can take advantage and create a situation more likable to us and this and that. But the point of the exercise of reading Dan, and Dan's, I think, are really the best articles I've ever read about A Clean Break and Coping with Crumbling States, because he really understands, and with the benefit of hindsight as well, he really understands just how wrong these neocons got it. I mean, they tell you exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it, and boy, are they ridiculous, stupid idiots. But David Wormser, why, he was Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor. Paul Wolfowitz, he was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Douglas Feith, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy, or Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy, whatever the hell, who ran the expanded Iraq desk, the Office of Special Plans, as well as the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, where they made up the lies about the weapons of mass destruction and the ties between Saddam and Osama to get us into that war. So, I think, you know what, maybe I'm really alone in this. Is this just a thing of mine? Responsibility is a quality, not a quantity. So I think that you could explain how Chalabi fooled Richard Pearl 100% without diminishing Richard Pearl's responsibility for his own actions and for being such a stupid idiot that he would let himself get played like that in the first place. They're both 100% responsible. How about they're both 500% responsible? And so's Bush, who had his own reasons for doing it. And Karl Rove, who had his own. And talk about petty, shallow reasons for doing it. A simple re-election, that's all. Bush Jr. wanted to prove that he was smarter and better and tougher than his dad. That was his overall reason to do it. Ariel Sharon, I guess, bought into David Wormser's same crap. I can't imagine the Likudniks thought, yeah, this is going to really empower Iran, which is exactly what we want. But again, just because somebody's powerful doesn't mean they're smart. And all they did was empower Iran from the first day on. I love the anecdote where I brought this up to Jonathan Landay on the show, and Landay said, I was there, man, in Kurdistan, and I watched Abdulaziz al-Hakim and the leaders of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq come across the border from Iran. And it was on. Thanks a lot for getting rid of Saddam for us, suckers. And now, I guess it more or less, you know, the Israelis, they don't seem to mind the chaos. But I'm sure they would have much preferred that Hashemite kingdom ruling Shiistan. Too bad it didn't quite work out that way for them. An oil water pipeline to Haifa. Yeah, it's going to be like the good old days under the British-backed king. All right. And then you know what, man? I'm sorry. Am I out of time? I'm almost out of time. But you know what? If you go to my Twitter feed and page down a bit, there's a bunch of cop crime stories that you guys should look at, man. Well, first of all, first grader suspended for 3 days for pretending to shoot, pretend to bow and arrow. I will not tolerate violence, says principal. Ha! I like how America is just a parody of itself at this point. I got a page down more. There's a bunch of people abused by the police here. Oh, this 7-year-old kid handcuffed for no reason. Not that he had done anything. Not that he'd swung his arm at anyone. Not that he had attempted to hurt himself or others, just because the cop felt like putting handcuffs on him. Oh, and then he lost the key and couldn't get the kid out of the handcuffs.
You go, yeah, I sure am glad there's a cop at my government school in case there's a massacre. Yeah, well, you're forgetting that the guy most likely to massacre somebody is the cop. Like, they're just going to stand there and do nothing all day waiting for a massacre that never comes. No, they're going to persecute your kid.